This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Most of us know more about The Sopranos than we know about what's happening in real mob families in America. Leaders of the Philadelphia mob just stood trial, and their story is representative of the state of the mafia. Reputed mob boss Joseph Skinny Joey Merlino and six co-defendants, five of whom were made men, were charged with running a criminal enterprise that used murder and threats of violence to generate income and control the Philadelphia, South Jersey underworld. The 15-week trial ended last week with convictions on charges of racketeering, but acquittals on the charges of murder and attempted murder. Joining us is reporter George Anastasia of the Philadelphia Inquirer, who covered the trial. He's been reporting on organized crime for 15 years. He says that Joey Merlino had not only risen to the top of his organization, he had become a high-profile celebrity gangster. I asked Anastasia how the FBI regarded Merlino and why they were so determined to convict him.
He was at one point the underboss, then he was the boss of the mob, but I think more important, he came to epitomize the mob in Philadelphia and the mob in America at the turn of the century, and the FBI saw him as this arrogant young guy who thought he could get away with murder, literally. And he was a celebrity gangster in that he was showing up at the chic nightclubs and at Phillies games and at Flyers games. People would come up and ask for his autograph. Everyone knew Joey, and Joey seemed to know everybody. And that, I think that got under the skin of the FBI.
I think he was even on Philadelphia Magazine's best dressed list one year.
Yes, he was included among the best dressed. And he gave a dinner for the homeless every Thanksgiving. It was a Christmas dinner, and he would have homeless people bust in, and there would be a lavish dinner. There would be a Christmas tree. There would be toys and presents, Santa Claus, a mummer's band would play. And that got lots of media coverage, and then that also got under the skin of the FBI there. And law enforcement in general would say, you know, it's easy to be generous when it's not your money that you're giving away. That was the take. And Merlino, on the other hand, said, I'm doing something for people in need, and what's the FBI doing? It was real street corner, kind of in-your-face kind of thing, back and forth between Merlino and those investigating him.
Now, was he born into organized crime? Was his father in the mob?
His father was Salvatore Chucky Merlino. His uncle was Lawrence Yogi Merlino. Both of them were involved with the Scarfo crime family in the late 70s, early 80s. Both were convicted. Salvatore Merlino is doing a 45-year sentence for racketeering. Ironically, Lawrence Merlino, his uncle, became a cooperating government witness in the 80s, one of several who flipped at that point. But yeah, he's second-generation gangster.
Now, before we go any deeper into this trial, what's this trial's importance in the national scene?
I think, you know, the trial itself is a typical RICO trial, not any different than what we've seen over the past 10 or 15 years. But I think Philadelphia has always been the prototype of what's going on in the American mafia, whether it was the 80s or the 90s or now. And what we saw in this trial is that this mob, this particular family in this particular city, is not much more than a street corner gang. This is not Cosa Nostra. This is a bunch of guys who grew up together, who hung on a corner together, who were involved in crimes. And I think Merlino typifies the American gangster, the American mafia figure at the turn of the century. It's no longer highly organized. It's not very sophisticated. And the whole idea of omerta, the code of silence, is kind of by the boards. These guys were loyal to one another because they grew up together. Literally, some of these guys were in first grade together and had all gone through school together. So it wasn't a question of we're not going to rat each other out because of omerta or because of the mafia. It was we're not going to rat each other out because we're from 12th and Wolf. We're from the same corner, and you don't do that to guys you grew up with.
So you think that organized crime, that the mafia, anyways, doesn't have the power that it once did, and this family is representative of that.
Right. It's no longer monolithic. It's no longer what it was. And whether it can ever be again, I think, is doubtful. I think we're seeing a third generation of American mafia figure, and they're just not made the same way as the guys were, say, in Carlo Gambino or Angelo Bruno's time. You know, for those guys, whether you accept it or not, those guys really believed in that whole idea of family and honor and loyalty. They took what I perceive as the positive values of the Italian-American community and kind of bastardized them to their own ends. But they truly believed in that. And a law enforcement figure once said to me, for a guy like Bruno in Philadelphia, a guy like Carlo Gambino in New York, the mafia was truly a way of life. For the next generation, for the John Gottis in New York, Nicky Scarfo here in Philadelphia, and certainly for Merlino, the mafia was a way to make money, but it wasn't a way of life. And I think that explains why so many mob figures have become cooperating witnesses. They get jammed up. They're looking at a RICO prosecution. They're looking at 40, 50, 60 years in prison. And if the mafia is not a way of life, but it's a way to make money, they make a business decision. How do I cut my losses? And the way they cut their losses is by becoming a cooperator for the government.
Now, if the mafia in Philly isn't what it once was, if it's basically a street corner gang that's into a lot of crime and maybe murder too, but it's still not this big organized crime syndicate anymore, why was this trial so important to the FBI?
Well, I think part of it was the personality. Joey Marino, the celebrity gangster, they wanted to bring him down. Part of it was, and I think this is where their case went off track. This investigation began in 1994, 1995, and the targets were Marino and Marino's boss, a guy named Ralph Natale. Now, Marino's in his 30s. Natale is 64 at the time, 63, just come out of prison after serving 15 years. He and Marino take control of this decimated Philadelphia mob. And Natale is the primary target. And they bug Natale's phone, they bug his apartment, they bug a restaurant at the Garden State Racetrack where he would hold afternoon meetings. And he is the guy they're going after. And they build a hell of a case against Natale. And they nail him on drug conspiracy. He's running a methamphetamine ring. And they've got tapes. And they've got evidence. And so they indict him and they arrest him. And Ralph Natale, at that point, 65, has done 15 years in prison, has two prior drug convictions. He's looking at life. And this is the way it's supposed to work. This was the FBI at its best. They get a mob boss and they nail him, and he's never coming out of jail. But Ralph Natale wants to get out of jail, and he says, "I'll cooperate." And the FBI, for whatever reason, decides to make a deal with the boss. And it's as if in New York they had made a deal with John Gotti to get Sammy Gravano. It doesn't make sense. I mean, you know, the boss, the head of the family, is the target. But they were...
So they made a deal with the number one to get the number two.
The irony was they kind of bought Ralph before they realized what Ralph was selling. And Ralph's testimony about the murders and the attempted murders that were the heart of this RICO case, the violence, was all secondhand. It was all hearsay. And the government had very little to corroborate or back him up. And I spoke to one of the jurors, and the jurors said, we believe they did all of this, but we weren't going to convict based on a belief. We wanted some evidence. And Ralph Natale was just giving us hearsay, and we couldn't convict based on his hearsay.
So what was at stake for the FBI in this trial?
You know, I don't know that there's really that much at stake for the FBI. I think the FBI has done this so often, they've nailed so many of these guys, that they just think they can do it by rote now. I think this may be a comeuppance in the sense that maybe somebody's going to take a step back now and say, wait a minute, we better think more about what we're doing. And if you look at what's happening across the country, I mean, there's a situation in Boston where there's an FBI agent who's been indicted for racketeering, who literally, figuratively, got in bed with two of his mob informants and allowed them to commit murders, possibly commit crimes, while they were informing. You've got a situation in New York with a mobster named Gregory Scarpa, same kind of situation. He was a high-level informant for the FBI. He also was committing possibly murders. You got Sammy Gravano, who cut his deal, went out to Arizona, is selling drugs. So there's been case after case. And then that's not even talking about the FBI's other problems outside of the organized crime. And I think all of this is indicative of kind of an arrogance that's kind of pervaded the FBI. And people are saying, maybe it's time to take a step back. Maybe we've got to look at who we're making deals with.
Now, Ralph Natale was the lead government witness against the crime family, although he used to be the head of the crime family in Philadelphia. He presented tape at the trial that he had recorded of conversations with fellow mobsters. What were some of the tapes like? What were some of the most interesting stuff that he got on tape?
Well, the tapes that Natale didn't record anything. Natale was being recorded. He was the target at the time these tapes were being made. But there were discussions with Merlino and others about, Natale said, about murders. But what they were talking about, he said he was talking in code. He was in prison at the time. He was talking to Merlino and others about this mob war that was raging in Philadelphia in 1993. And John Stanfa headed the rival mob faction. And Natale and Merlino were going to wipe out the Stanfa organization and take over. And so he would call from prison and he would talk to these fellows and he would talk about, is anybody doing any work? You got to keep working hard. You know, you got to get out there and put your boots on and go to work. And he said those were references to getting out there and killing members of this organization. The jury wanted to see more than that. They didn't. And I think that's one of the reasons they rejected his testimony. There were also tapes of Natale. I mean, some of the most interesting did not even relate to the charges in this case. It was Natale on tape when he was being bugged at his home on his phone, talking about the way he was going to corrupt and take control of the city of Camden. And it was basically about taking over construction companies, getting awarded bids and contracts, government money, and then ripping the government off. And on one tape, he talks about how you do this. And he says, you know, We're not building the Taj Mahal. It doesn't have to last forever. If it lasts 5 years, that's fine. If I have to use 20 nails, I'll use 10. If I have to use 3 wires, I'll use 1. Who's going to know the difference? And it was those kind of insights into, you know, this is the way this stuff happens, and this is where we all pay a price on all that. Those, to me, were the far more interesting tapes than these vague references to, is this a murder, is it not a murder? And those tapes related to Natalia and who he was and the way he was trying to run the organization. And I think those gave you more insight into the way the mob operates, what they try to do, and why we should all be concerned. You know, people say, what do you care about wise guys? They kill one another. They don't bother me. I don't bother them. When they impact on society, whether it's construction or the control of the price of cheese or trash collection, those are the things we have to care about. And they're always reaching out and trying to get their hands into that kind of stuff.
What happens to Ralph Natale now? He was the head of the Philadelphia crime family. He was in prison for many years. But now he was the lead witness against the crime family. So what happens to him?
Well, that's the question that hung in the air over the trial. Natale has pled guilty to murder and drug trafficking. He's looking at a potential life sentence. Because of his cooperation, government prosecutors say at the time of sentencing, they'll tell the judge the extent of what he did for the government and ask for a downward departure in federal guidelines. Now, no one knows what he's going to receive in terms of a sentence, but he's 66 years old, and he clearly does not want to die in prison. And the defense implied that he's already been promised that he'll get out of jail. Now, if he gets a 5-year sentence, he's already done 3, he'll be out very shortly. If he gets a 7 to 10 year sentence, he'll do a little bit more time. But ultimately, Ralph Natale is going to get out of jail and go back to doing whatever it is that he does.
How long is he likely to live when he gets out of jail?
You know, if this was 20 years ago, I would say not very long. But Sammy Gravano did much the same thing in New York, at even a higher profile than Natale. And Gravano surfaced in Arizona. It was no secret where he was. And he was able to survive, thrive, and get involved in drugs without anybody coming out and trying to kill him. I think the day of the mob tracking down the rats is long gone. They don't have the capability to do that anymore.
My guest is Philadelphia Inquirer reporter George Anastasia. He's covered organized crime for 15 years. He just covered the 15-week trial of Philadelphia's reputed mob boss, Joey Merlino, and 6 of his associates. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is George Anastasia, and he's been covering organized crime in Philadelphia for 15 years, and he just covered the Joey Merlino crime trial for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Who were the other witnesses that turned against their own crime family in the Joey Merlino trial?
There were 3 other admitted mobsters. Ron Previty, who, ironically, Previty is a former Philadelphia cop who became a wise guy and then became an FBI informant. There was Gaetano Tommy Horsehead Scafidi, a longtime friend and associate of Merlino and the others. And there was Pete the Crumb Caprio, a 70-year-old gangster from Newark who was part of the Newark branch of the Philadelphia mob. I think the most compelling of all the witnesses was Tommy Scafidi. Horsehead Scafidi, and he clearly did not want to be on the witness stand, and he talked about
He actually cried one day and said that everything he believed in he was violating
exactly.
By ratting on his friends.
Right. Tommy Scafidi, I think, opened the window to here's what the mob was and here's what it has become, and this is why we are where we are today. He's a fellow who said his grandfather, his uncles, and his brother were all made members of the mob. So he was a third-generation gangster. And he talked about the way things were supposed to be. And then he talked about the way they had changed when Joey Merlino took over, and it wasn't the way it was supposed to be. And he was trying to live by the rules of the mob, and Merlino and those guys were still going to kill him. And he didn't understand why. And the frustration and the anger and the disappointment clearly came out when he was on the witness stand.
Why were they going to kill him?
In the middle of the mob war in 1993, he had switched sides. He had gone with the Stanford organization because he said Joey and those guys were not really doing it the way you're supposed to do it. And he was a true in-the-blood gangster. And he was sentenced to a 7-year prison sentence for racketeering, doing his time, didn't rat anybody out. And that's what he said. He said, I didn't rat anybody out. I did what I was supposed to do. I was a stand-up guy. And still they were telling me I was going to get killed when I came out, even though their boss, Ralph Natale, he had flipped and he was cooperating against them. They still were talking about killing me. And finally, the feds went to him and said, Tommy, you got nowhere to go. You're either going to get indicted again and spend the rest of your life in jail, or these guys are going to kill you. What do you want to do? And that's when he started to cry. And he said he had no option. He didn't want to be there. He didn't want to be testifying. But that's the only alternative that was left. And that, to me, really told a story about where the whole idea of honor and loyalty is gone. It's probably left 5 or 10 years ago, but it really hit home at this trial. There's no more honor and loyalty. It's treachery. It's about making money. It's about grabbing it with both fists and getting all you can and forgetting about everybody else.
Now, with Natale, the lead witness against the Philadelphia crime family, who used to be the head of the crime family, do you think he had any personal motivations outside of wanting to get out of prison?
Oh, I think there was a lot of animosity, a lot of personal animosity between him and Merlino and George Borghese, another co-defendant, Stevie Mazzone, another co-defendant, but primarily Merlino and Borghese. There was a lot of their whole relationship had started to fall apart even before Natale was indicted on drug charges and was in a jackpot. And a lot of it went back to lifestyle. A lot of it went back to they were in their 30s. He was in his 60s. He had a 30-year-old girlfriend, which was a cause of friction.
Why was that a cause of friction?
Well, I over the course of several years, I've gotten to know these guys. And these guys were talking to me while they were out on the streets, and for whatever reason. And one of the problems was the girlfriend was a woman from South Philadelphia who they all knew. And he was kind of holding her up as someone they had to show deference to. And one of these guys said to me, you know, she's a girl from Broad and Snyder. He wants us to treat her like she's Princess Di. He said, we knew her before he knew her. We know who she is. You know, and it was that kind of, it was really a street corner kind of thing. You know, who does he think he is? Who does she think she is? And that created a lot of, it sounds petty, but in that world that they move in, that was, you know, it was all about face, respect, all of that kind of stuff. And so the relationship between Natale and the young guy started to deteriorate. Then he went away to jail first on a parole violation. And he says they had promised to send money for his prison commissary, send money to his wife, because Natale was still married, and also send money to his girlfriend. And he said after about a month or two, the money stopped coming. He said it was like I was dead. He was hurt by that. So all of these, you know, there's a lot of different dynamics going on in this. Oh, separate and apart from the actual criminality.
Now, the prosecutors presented some videotape at the trial. What were the videos?
The most interesting video, and we had seen this in the Stanford trial as well, it was a video of a mob hit in progress. Joseph Ciangolini Jr., the underboss of the Stanford organization, is opening his luncheonette about, it's 5:58 in the morning because you see the video, the clock is ticking, and it's pre-dawn. And then you see a car drive by, the lights go on in the deli, then you see some shadowy figures run in. You hear a waitress scream, and you hear gunfire, because in addition to videotaping, they had bugged the deli. And then you see the shadowy figures run out. Ciangolini was wounded. He survived. It was a brutal hit. He's crippled. He's disabled, even to this day. The attempted murder of Joe Ciangolini was one of the racketeering acts for which Merlino and the others were put on trial. And this was portrayed as the start of the mob war in 1993 between the Stanford faction and the Merlino faction. Joe Ciangolini Jr. was Stanford's underboss. Tommy Scafidi testified that he was one of those shadowy figures, that he and Borghese and Mazzone and a fellow named Michael Lancelotti ran in that day. And another co-defendant, Martin Angelino, was driving the getaway car, and Joey Merlino was serving as the lookout. He testified that that's the way it went down. The jury saw that videotape. But in the videotape, you can't make out the figures. It's dark and shadowy. You can't make any identification. The defense presented some counter testimony. Some people who said, no, there weren't four, there were three people there. They didn't match the descriptions of the individual Scafidi identified. They had a testimony from an EMT who arrived on the scene who said that Joe Ciangolini in his delirium said, Tim did me. Well, none of these defendants were named Tim. So those kind of things undermined the testimony of the government. All of that played out, and subsequently they reached a not proven in that particular charge. So they were not found guilty of the Ciangolini shooting, even though Tommy Scafidi said, I was there, I was one of the gunmen, and this is the way I went down.
That must have really hurt the prosecution.
Well, that was one
to
of the...
To have a video like that, and it's still, you know, it's not enough.
That was one of the stronger... Of the murders and attempted murders, and there were five or six in total, that was one of the stronger pieces of evidence and one of the stronger charges. And they were very disappointed that that one didn't result in a guilty verdict.
What was it like for you to watch this tape?
Well, I had seen it before. When it was first played, it's very dramatic because, you know, you can have a witness talk to you about the way something happens, but when you hear it, I mean, it happens very quickly, and it's very much staccato, you know, and you see the shadowy figures run in, you hear the scream of the waitress, and then you hear this gunfire, about five or six shots, boom, boom, and then the feet are pounding, and they come out, and they go off camera because the camera is focused on the entrance to the delicatessen, and these shadowy figures disappear. And it only takes a matter of... Like I said, I think it starts at 5:58. By 5:59 and some seconds, it's done. And when you think about it, and in the aftermath, the testimony from the EMT about Joe Ciangolini's state of mind, she said, an ear had been blown off, an eye had been shot out. There was blood coming out of every orifice in his face. When she got to him, he was so disconcerted, he tried to grab a towel she was using to stop the bleeding, and he wanted to blow his nose. She was afraid to let him blow his nose, afraid he might blow his brains out. That's how severely he had been damaged. That kind of testimony, that brought it all to ground level. I mean, this is what this is about. There's nothing glamorous about this. This is brutality at its essence. That's what this was. And even with that, they couldn't convict because they didn't have enough evidence. But it was very dramatic testimony, and the video was part and parcel of that.
George Anastasia is a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. We'll talk more about organized crime in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with reporter George Anastasia of the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's been reporting on organized crime for 15 years. Anastasia says the story of the Philadelphia mob is representative of the larger story of organized crime today. Anastasia just covered the 15-week-long trial of Philadelphia's reputed mob boss, Joey Merlino, and six of his associates. They were accused of racketeering and using murder and threats of violence to control the Philadelphia and South Jersey underworld. Now, although the prosecution lost on the murder and attempted murder charges, they did win convictions on the grounds of extortion and racketeering.
Right. Oh, there were each defendant was convicted of racketeering, and the basis for the racketeering conviction was either extortion, bookmaking, receipt of stolen property, collection of an unlawful debt. So each one is facing anywhere from 7 to 10 years. So while the defense may say this is a victory for us, I don't know that sitting in prison for 7 to 10 years, after a month or two, you're going to wonder how it was kind of a hollow victory. You know what I mean? If you're a defendant.
Now, the prosecution was saying, well, this really is a victory in spite of the fact we didn't win convictions on the murder charges, because the jury acknowledged that these aren't just like freelance criminals. This is the Cosa Nostra.
Right.
Now, you were saying that this trial really shows that the Cosa Nostra doesn't really much exist anymore. They're kind of like street corner criminals. So what's the difference between your point of view and the prosecution's point of view on that?
I think what this case showed is not it's not that these guys aren't Cosa Nostra. It's that Cosa Nostra is not what it used to be. And should we be spending all this time and energy to nail these street punks is what it comes down to. And I think that's where we are. At this point, post-verdict, everybody's got to spin the thing in their best possible light that they can. And the government is correct. They want a conviction. And the jury did say this was a criminal enterprise, Cosa Nostra. These guys were a part of it, and they're guilty of racketeering. In that light, yeah, it's a victory for the government. On the other hand, the most serious charges and the ones that meant the most, especially to, you think about it, the families of the guys that were killed. I mean, it's a very hollow victory for them. I mean, who, at the end of the day, Joe Sedano, Anthony Tura, and Billy Vizi are still dead. And the guys the government said killed them are getting a walk on those charges. And the other problem with that is once you've been acquitted, you can't be tried again. If they come up with more evidence down the road, they can't retry them on those charges. And that's where I think they went off track with Natale. Had they waited and not included some of these murders in this racketeering case, a year or two from now, maybe one of these guys, as he's doing 10 years, is going to say, hey, maybe I should cooperate. And they come back with a much more solid case to put those murders in another RICO. I mean, I think it was a rush. And I think that's why they got off track here.
Do you know what the Philadelphia organized crime family has its fingers in now? What enterprises it has a take on? What enterprises it controls?
Well, I mean, it's what it's always been. It's gambling and loan sharking. There was testimony, in fact, in this trial about an ongoing investigation into video poker machines. These guys got a lot of video poker machines in bars and restaurants, and that's part of illegal gambling operations. Bookmaking, loan sharking, those kind of things. I mean, that's the traditional, that's the wheel around which the mob operates. What we're not seeing too much of, and what we had seen in the 70s and the 80s, is control of labor unions, corruption of judges, influence in the political arena. I mean, there's less and less of that, and I think it's because these guys are less and less sophisticated. They don't know how to do that.
Are these guys connected to Atlantic City gambling? Atlantic City is very close to Philadelphia.
Atlantic City has always been the plum of the Philadelphia crime family. I mean, that's the diamond. That's where all the action is. And the Philadelphia family has had less and less influence from Bruno in the 1980s to Merlino in the year 2000. One of the things Natale talked about on some of these tapes was reestablishing control of the bartenders union in Atlantic City. Natale, before he went away to jail in the late 70s, was a bartender union official in South Jersey. And he and Bruno talked about, we control the bartenders union, we'll control the casinos. And they foreshadowed what was to happen, because while Bruno was killed in 80 and Natale went to jail in 79, Scarfo, who succeeded Bruno, took control of that bartenders union. And that's the way he made millions of dollars off the casino industry in the early days of casino gambling. Ultimately, the feds came in, took control of that union, placed a monitor in control of the union, and drove the mob out. But Natale wanted to go back to that. And that's something that these younger guys, they don't have the foresight. They don't see that. I mean, Joey, one of the things that came out about Joey Marino was he was live for today. You know, I'm going to go party today. If I got $5,000 in my pocket, by the end of the night, I'll have nothing in my pocket, but tomorrow I'll get another $5,000 and go party again. It was that kind of attitude. And that's not long-term thinking. You know, that's not the way you run a corporation. And again, to go back to the older guys, I mean, you can make an argument that Carlo Gambino in New York, Angelo Bruno in Philadelphia, in another time, in another era, they probably could have been the CEO of a company. You know, they came to this country as immigrants, and for whatever reason, they chose to get involved in organized crime, maybe because there weren't as many opportunities presented to them as Italian immigrants in the 1920s. Now, today, I mean, I think the best and the brightest in the Italian-American community are doctors and lawyers and journalists. And what you're left with are the guys who can't do anything else. They're the gangsters. They become heads of the crime family. They don't bring that level of sophistication to what they do.
George Anastasia is my guest, and he's been covering organized crime in Philadelphia for 15 years. He just covered the Joey Merlino trial, and George Anastasia writes for the Philadelphia Inquirer. There was one afternoon at the Merlino trial where the subject was you,
yes.
George Anastasia.
Yes, unfortunately.
What were they saying about you?
Ralph Natale was on the stand, and Ralph Natale was very upset at some articles I had written shortly after he began to cooperate. And the gist of the article was, Natale's cooperated because he's jammed up on a drug deal, and because he's got prior drug convictions, he's looking at life. And one of the reasons he got involved in a drug dealing was he needed a lot of money. And the reason he needed a lot of money was, in addition to his wife, he had a 30-year-old girlfriend who he was putting in an apartment in Voorhees, New Jersey, and buying a summer, renting a summer home for her in Margate, New Jersey, and buying her dresses and this, that, and the other thing. And, you know, he was leading a double life, and he had this young girl, and he was very upset with that article. And the irony is, I knew all of that for about 2 years and never had a reason to write it, because that was his personal life, and it didn't impact on anything. But when it became a reason for him to cooperate, then I thought it was a legitimate news story. And he was convinced that some of the wise guys around Merlino were feeding me that information, and they were trying to get back at him through me, and I became a pawn for Merlino and those guys. And he kind of lashed out at me on the witness stand, said I was a fraud, said, you know, I was in Joey Merlino's pocket. And then when he was challenged on it, he backed off a little bit and said he had no proof of that. But, you know, it was very disconcerting to be the focus of testimony in a federal RICO trial. And that's where it all stemmed from.
Did you have any idea that was going to happen?
Yes, I did. I knew it was coming because there had been some taped phone conversations between Natale and his wife in prison that the defense had gotten a hold of. They're entitled to all those kind of things. And on those tapes, he had gone on the same rant about me. So I knew it was coming. The one thing that bothered me was that the defense brought this up to try to show the jury this Natale lashes out at anybody. The one thing they didn't ask Natale was, those articles that bother you, what was wrong? What was inaccurate in those articles? And had they asked that, the articles were very accurate, and they kind of foreshadowed what was coming. But it was very disconcerting, and it wasn't a pleasant afternoon for me, no.
Are you worried at all that if Ralph Natale is that angry with you, and if he feels that his friends ratted him out to you and you went with it and that you're biased, does that mean you're not safe?
No, I don't think so. I mean, Ralph Natale is, I think this trial showed that, a lot of talk but not a lot of substance. And it would be foolish for him to try to do anything to anybody, let alone come after a reporter. That's going to just call too much attention to himself. The only time I had a real problem was back when John Stanford was the mob boss. And Stanford was born and raised in Sicily. And in 1993, when I was writing about the mob war, he was very upset, and he told one of his henchmen to find out where I live, get some hand grenades, and throw them in the window. Now, I found out about this maybe 3 years later when the henchman became a cooperating witness, and he told the FBI about this, and he called me up on the phone from prison, and he said, look, some stuff's going to come out about you. I want to let you know it was nothing personal. And I said, well, you know, I got a wife and two kids. Grenades come through my window. It's very personal. And then he said, by the time we got the hand grenades, we were so caught up in this war with Joey Merlino that you were not a priority anymore, so we never pursued you. So I found out about a serious threat much after the fact. It was 3 years after the fact. And I think that was an aberration because Stanford coming from Sicily, in Sicily they kill judges, they kill lawyers, they kill reporters. Anybody who's not with them is against them. The American mob guys, by and large, they don't like the fact that you write about them, but they tolerate you. And this next group, the Merlino group, they weren't afraid of the media, and they seemed to enjoy, you know, getting back at the government by making comments to the media. That's another thing that was unique about this group. They used us. I mean, and much the same way a political party uses you. You know, here's what's really going on. You want to look at this, or why don't you look at that? And throughout this investigation, and even prior to it, I would get calls from these guys, and I'd be able to write a story that law enforcement says ABC. However, according to one underworld source, it's XYZ. And for some reason, they enjoyed that. That they liked to go at it with the cops, you know.
But you felt that they were spinning the story the way politicians spin stories.
And you know, I would always try to check things out before I print them. But there were a lot of times where they were telling me things that were valid, and the government was trying to spin it in their way, and they were spinning it in another direction. I don't know why they wanted to do that. I mean, a guy like Angelo Bruno would never bother to. He wouldn't care about what the paper was saying. And Scarfo may have hated me, but he wouldn't give me the time of day. It didn't matter to him what was in the media. These guys seem to care about that.
Maybe that's in part because they like being celebrities, and the more they're quoted or photographed, the more of a celebrity they become.
I think that's part of it. And I think the other part of it is they're from the corner, and you don't let any insult go by. You've got to respond. If you don't respond, it's like you're beaten or you're afraid. So they've got to respond. So if the government's saying this about them, they want to have an answer.
My guest is George Anastasia, a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Philadelphia Inquirer reporter George Anastasia. He's covered organized crime for 15 years. He just covered the 15-week trial of Philadelphia's reputed mob boss, Joey Merlino, and six of his associates. Now, all the guys who are on trial in the Joey Merlino trial, which just ended, they're all behind bars, with the exception of one guy who's out on bail. Who's he?
Angelo Lutz was the only one who qualified for bail because he wasn't charged with any crimes of violence, any of the murders or attempted murders. Angelo was a 5'5", 400-pound South Philadelphia bon vivant. The government said he was a mob associate. He said he was a degenerate gambler who grew up with these guys, was a boyhood friend, was involved in gambling, was involved in some of the activities, but not on behalf of the mob, simply on behalf of himself. And he got up and testified to that effect. The jury didn't buy it. They convicted him, and he's looking at, ironically, when all is said and done, he'll look at a sentence almost as severe as Merlino's, even though he was convicted of gambling, unlawful collection of debts, and extortion, and that they were collecting money from guys, bookmakers who weren't affiliated. But Angelo, I mean, the other thing, I mean, people say, you know, Angelo threw himself in the spotlight and he got what was coming because he was so outspoken. The problem, and this is a problem, I guess, with us, with the media, since Angelo was the only defendant who could come to and from the courthouse every day, he was the one the cameras flocked to every day, which is only natural. And he reacted, I guess, the way anybody would, human nature. You're sitting in court all day, people are saying things about you, you want to respond. And he used the media to respond. And he became something of a celebrity. And then other people were saying, you know, who the hell does he think he is? You know, he's just asking for trouble by doing this. And that's the situation he's in right now.
And he's colorful, too, and that kind of helped him get a lot of press.
Yeah. I mean, he's a typical South Philadelphia corner guy. He's quick on his feet. He's funny. He's great to go to lunch with. He's entertaining. He's a great cook. He's involved in the Mummers. He's a musician. You know, that's one of the things that I think from covering these guys as long as I have, that's one of the things I've come to see. People think these guys are one-dimensional, and they're not. I mean, I think this is one of the reasons why the show The Sopranos is so popular. You know, Tony Soprano's got a wife. He's got a girlfriend. He's got kids who won't listen to him. He's got guys who work for him who won't do what he tells them. I mean, the dynamics of everyday life.
Is there anybody in the Philadelphia mob who reminds you at all of Tony Soprano or of any of the other characters on the show?
Well, I think Angelo Lutz is probably the closest to one of the characters in The Sopranos because he comes across as larger than life and you know, very outspoken and funny and entertaining. Joey, I mean, I had lunch with Joey a couple of times. I had lunch with Joey, and you sit down and talk to him, and you go back and you look at your notebook, and there's nothing there. You know, he talks without saying anything. And if there's anybody who, of all of these guys, who I think really understands the way it's supposed to be, even if he didn't always live the way it's supposed to be, it was Joey. The rest of these guys, I think they don't quite reach the level of what we would consider the real live gangsters. They were, like I said, street corner guys.
How much of that conversation with Joey Merlino over lunch is on the record, you know, journalists tell me what's happening talk, and how much of it is kind of small talk or talk that's off the record?
Well, I mean, we always made that clear. I said, Joey, I'm working on a story about X, Y, and Z. What, if anything, do you want to say about that? And then if he wanted to say something, he would say it. And then we would talk, but a lot of small talk about his kids, about family, all that kind of things. And he's got two young daughters. He knows I have two older daughters. We would talk about those kind of things. He would always ask, too. He would remember. He would, I met him one time, and then he would always ask, how's your daughters doing, that kind of thing. You know, he's very charming and personable in that way. And then, you know, he would talk in general, and he wasn't educated, but he read. He read the newspapers all the time. He could tell you about cases in New York, legal decisions that might impact his life. You know, he would keep on top of those kind of things. And anything that was negative about the FBI, Ruby Ridge, down in Texas with David Karrasch, that kind of stuff, he knew all about those kind of things. And he read all of that because he had this antipathy toward the FBI.
Since we've brought up The Sopranos, yeah. Do you watch the show?
Religiously. I think it's a great show. And for the reasons I said, I mean, I think it's what it's about is the human condition, and the mob is the backdrop. But Tony Soprano is every man, and he's trying to deal with all of these things. And it's, you know, I've been in debates with a lot of Italian American groups that go nuts about this, and I don't see it that way. I mean, we're talking about an ethnic group, Italian Americans, who in my lifetime currently have given America Anton Scalia and Camille Paglia. If we can do that. You know, we don't have to worry about Tony Soprano being our poster boy. You know what I mean? I mean, and anybody with any kind of intelligence and sophistication realizes that, you know, what Italian-Americans have contributed to America. And Sopranos is entertainment. It's well-written. It's one of the best things on television. If you don't like it, change the channel.
What about, you know, concerns that, like, The Sopranos romanticize organized crime? Not because it's a romantic series, but, you know, it's just become so cool to watch it and cool to know gangsters and to know people who are like Tony Soprano.
Well, I mean, that's America's always been fascinated with, whether it's Billy the Kid and Jesse James or Al Capone or John Gotti or in this case, Tony Soprano. I think one of the things David Chase did this year was to de-glamorize that show. If you look, and people complain now about this, the violence this year and the brutality. I think David Chase was saying to his critics, these are who these guys are. They shouldn't be, you know, nobody should idolize what these guys do. They're beating up a go-go dancer. They're turning on one another. And that was, very true to life, the treachery and all of that. And I think David Chase was responding to his critics this year with that stuff.
Are you from South Philadelphia, the Italian neighborhood in Philadelphia, where a lot of the mob came from?
I was born in South Philadelphia. My parents grew up in South Philadelphia. When I was 4 years old, we became part of the diaspora. We moved over to the South Jersey, you know, part of the migration over to the suburbs. So I grew up in southern New Jersey. But I've always had relatives in South Philadelphia. We've always come back, and I've got a sense of what South Philadelphia is, yeah.
Did you know mob-connected people when you were growing up?
You know, bookmakers, not really serious guys, gamblers, bookmakers, those kind of things. I spent a lot of time as a kid in Atlantic City every summer, and Atlantic City was the where everybody from South Philadelphia went at that time, the 50s and the 60s. So, yeah, I knew a lot of people who were around this kind of stuff, but it was more Damon Runyon guys and dolls than Goodfellas, you know what I mean?
What was the scene like in the courthouse during the Joey Merlino trial?
It was an event. I mean, both papers, my paper, The Inquirer, and the Philadelphia Daily News, did pieces early on about the fashion of the defendants and of the wives and the mothers and fathers who were coming there. It was a real fashion show, and it was an event. It was, in a lot of ways, a soap opera. We got to know a lot of them, and everyone would go to lunch at the same Italian restaurant about a block from the courthouse, and it was as if it was buffet style. And it's called Pagano's, and it was like Pagano's was catering the event because everybody would go there every afternoon. It was you know, and you get to know people.
Did you go there?
Most afternoons, because you got to talk to people. It was good to, you know, you get access to folks. So, yeah, any trial that you cover for a length of time like this, whether I covered another big murder trial down in Delaware involving Tom Capano a couple years ago, the dynamic of the people, you generate relationships because you're all kind of in the bunker together for a long period of time, and you get to know each other, and you talk about your kids and your life outside of this cocoon that you're wrapped in for 8 hours every day, 5 days a week, 12, 15 weeks of the year.
You know, I was concerned about your safety because of a couple of the stories that you mentioned. But on the other hand, it seems like you've been at this for so long, 15 years, covering organized crime in Philadelphia, that everyone in organized crime, they know who you are. They know what you write. They should know that you're fair and a good writer. And so you're a regular part of their environment. You're not some kind of newcomer who might be a threat in surprising ways.
Yeah, I think
so
I
come... So in that sense, you're probably pretty accepted and maybe even pretty trusted?
I come with the territory. And some of them trust me more than others. There are others who are just leery of the media. But yeah, they know who I am. And I think over the course of the years I've been doing it, they understand what I'm trying to do. And I think by and large, they think I've reported fairly on what's going on. So yeah, I mean, it's the kind of relationship you develop with whenever you're covering a beat for any length of time, whether it's education, whether it's organized labor, whether it's politics. If you work at it for a long time, people start to know you and they understand where you're coming from. And if you do it a decent job, and I think I have, you're accepted.
Since the trial has ended and since the FBI lost on the murder charges, have you spoken to any members of the FBI about what you feel they learned from the trial and what they might have done differently if they had it to do all over again?
I haven't spoken to anyone in the FBI. I talked to some people with the U.S. Attorney's Office, the prosecutors, and they were disappointed. But I think in their heart of hearts, they knew that some of the murder charges were not as good as others, and they thought they were going to lose some of them. They didn't think they were going to lose all of them. And I think one of the things we'll see as a result of this trial, and it's probably a good thing, is that the U.S. Attorney's Office will try to keep tighter reins on the way an investigation is going down and not let the FBI just kind of go out there and make the case and bring it to them. I mean, they've got to take this into court and put it in front of a jury. They're the ones that got to stand behind what comes in, and I think they may want to have more input into how it's built rather than just taking the finished cake and bringing it in and putting it on the table.
Well, George Anastasia, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
George Anastasia is a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air.